There's Janice, Get It While You Can. From HighTimes.com, a survey of 11 presidents who supposedly smoked marijuana. President number 35, you guessed it, John F. Kennedy, no surprise there. JFK used marijuana to deal with severe back pain. And according to a few written accounts, including John F. Kennedy, a biography, which described this White House scene, on the evening of July 16, 1962, this according to Washington Post executive Jim Truitt, Kennedy and Mary Meyer smoked marijuana together. The president smoked 3 of the 6 joints Mary brought to him. At first, he felt no effects. Then he closed his eyes and refused a 4th joint. Suppose the Russians did something now, he reportedly said. Presidents number 14, 12, and 7, that's Franklin Pierce, Zachary Taylor, and Andrew Jackson, all smoked marijuana. In fact, they were rather fond of smoking it. They smoked it with their fellow military men during the Mexican-American War. James Monroe openly smoked hashish while he was an ambassador to France and continued smoking it until his death at the age of 83. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, claimed that hemp gave him the insight to create a new democratic nation. We'll get back to more of your questions and comments for Dr. David Kasserit as we discuss medical marijuana right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Dr. David Kasserit talking medical marijuana here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Before the break, David, I was asking you about where we're at in terms of matching a particular strain of medical marijuana or the plant with the actual ailment.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one of the questions that I think I've heard most often, probably from all of the patients I've talked with. We don't really know. We know a little bit about what goes into those strains. So, for instance, the 2 main cannabinoids that are most prevalent, and they're the ones that we know the most about in terms of effects. They may not be the most important, but based on what we know now, they're THC and CBD. And rather than thinking about particular strains, because there are hundreds, thousands of them out there, it's useful, I found, in getting my head around this, it's useful thinking rather than names of strains, it's useful thinking about strains that are either high in THC, strains that are high in CBD, or both, or sometimes neither. That's actually an easier way to begin to make sense of what might be helpful for specific ailments. It's also something that's helpful to patients as they go into dispensaries who may not be familiar the first couple of times around with all of the names of strains. Having said that, though, we don't know a lot about what THC does and what CBD does. As I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, people used to think that neuropathic pain was most effectively treated by THC. People are beginning to realize that CBD might actually have some effects. And so this is still speculative, but one response would be for ailments like neuropathic pain, you may not need strains that are high in THC. You might actually be able to get a lot of benefit from strains that are high in CBD, of which there are dozens, if not hundreds, out there. More speculative still, there's some evidence that CBD is helpful in treating inflammation associated with autoimmune disorders, or some people say multiple sclerosis, maybe, or arthritis. Again, we don't really know, but that might be, if you think that might be the case, and you believe in that, then strains that are low in THC and CBD, higher in CBD would be useful. And as we talked about before, for childhood seizures, the best guess right now is that it's CBD rather than THC in those concentrated oils that are most effective. So that science still is fairly young, but I found it helpful to think not so much in terms of strains, but in terms of what's high or low in terms of THC and CBD.
And to that end, in terms of trying to match strains to ailments or finding, getting data, in these states where medical marijuana is legal, Are there databases up and running to sort of track this kind of information anecdotally?
Not nearly as many as there should be. And I have to say that states have been very slow and have missed some opportunities, frankly. You know, medical marijuana has been legal in a lot of states for a while, and states are just beginning to set up registries, which is why the Kickstarter campaign we have for marijuanaresults.org is probably too late. I mean, we really should have had this sort of community sharing site 10 or 20 years ago, but better late than never. I have been led to understand that in Canada, I think they have begun starting these registries as well, I believe, in Washington State in the U.S. So some of these registries are coming online, and gradually we'll begin to learn, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up.
All right, let's go back to the phones. On the wild card line, Greg is in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Greg. Welcome to Coast.
Gentlemen, good morning, world. In response to your High Times article, I think the current administration, all the congressmen up there, I think they're all on some stupid pill. But my question is there a difference between your cannabis oil there and hash oil and peyote oil? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks, gentlemen.
Good question, Greg.
Well, thanks. So yes and no. So the oils that are derived from marijuana come in a variety of different forms. People talk about concentrates more generally, which go by a variety of names. Oil, hash is a less concentrated form. Butter, wax, shatter are much more concentrated forms. They all have a lot in common in the sense that, I talk in the book about how these things are made. I got to visit a guy in a city that I promised I wouldn't name, who makes hash and other forms of concentrated oil, and he shows me how he makes them by extracting the trichomes, the very concentrated bits of THC and CBD cannabinoids in marijuana, and concentrating them to a substance that's anywhere from 30 to sometimes 80 plus percent THC or CBD. And so those various forms, whether it's hash or oil or butter, are often made through the same process with varying concentrations, but they're much more concentrated than the typical 5-7 or so percent in a marijuana bud. As far as the peyote concentrates that you talked about, they're obviously different substance. You're starting with a different plant with different stuff in them.
That's a hallucinogen, isn't it? Isn't it psilocybin, related to psilocybin? Peyote?
Psilocybin, I believe, actually, I don't know. Psilocybin, I thought, came from a mushroom, but that should be my next book, because now I'm curious.
All right, let's say hi to Josie on the wildcard line, checking in from Richmond, Virginia. Josie, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
A very early good morning to you all. I am an herbalist, and I believe in the common sense with the alternative medicine, and I am strong on alternative medicine, and I have a lot of questions. By the way, Andrew Jackson, in this life, apparently, according to a book, Return of the Revolutionaries, he's John Kerry. In this life. Thought you all might be interested. But anyhow.
All right, I'll have to look into that. I'll have to do a photo comparison.
A book out called The Return of the Revolutionaries. They have pictures of them. Sometimes they look alike, too. It's amazing.
Did Andrew Jackson fall off his bicycle?
Bill, you look at the $20 bill, and you'll see a kind of a likeness of John Kerry. But that was Andrew Jackson. But anyhow, I'm calling because I am so strong on getting this done, and I really think we need to all scream at our congressman to get everything off Schedule 1. The Schedule 1 business is just ridiculous, particularly for industrial hemp, which Virginia has finally allowed for researchers and universities to plant. And in the meantime, the EPA says, well, you got to clean up your rivers, and all those pesticides that could be taken up by industrial hemp can't be done. Because they won't allow farmers to in a widespread manner, broadcast this industrial hemp. But in the meantime, I have a question about a substance that is, somewhat, to my knowledge, is only really researched by the University of Calgary up there in Canada, which is makes me kind of interested. This is called ibotabanath, or ibogaine is the pill form of it. And since they won't allow it because it's on Schedule 1-2, but what it does is it makes people who are hooked on marijuana or hooked on, they're not hooked on so much on marijuana as heroin or some other substance like that, or alcohol, it gets you so you don't want to use it anymore. So why wouldn't they just, and poor Dr. Mash was trying to experiment with it by taking people offshore and everything, but, you know, it was such a pressure by the government, she finally gave up on the whole thing. But it's really, I don't know if you know, doctor, of what has been done so far, because my knowledge is about 10 years old. If there's any advances anywhere at the University of Calgary or anywhere else on this ibogaine or ibogaine, you have to go to Africa to get it, to Ghana, I think central Ghana. You can go with the Vision Quest people and take.
Well, I know that ayahuasca is being used to treat certain addictions.
This is this country. You have to go to Africa and you take this horrible tasting root. That's why ibogaine might be more easy.
All right, let's get David in here and see if he's familiar with this. Thank you for the call, Josie.
Yeah, thanks. The short answer is the only thing I know about ibogaine was what I learned way back when I was in graduate school in medical anthropology, as I was also a medical student. And I remember it as being an alkaloid, an indole alkaloid that has psychoactive properties. That was used, I believe, in Africa. That's going back 15 years into my memory, though. I'm not aware of anything that involves its therapeutic use now. That does not mean that it's not being used. It's just I haven't heard of it since medical school.
All right. Thanks again for the call, Josie. Who is involved in growing medical marijuana? I would imagine there'd be, you know, vast fortunes to be made, but what types of people are involved in growing medical marijuana?
Well, I think your first point is probably the most important, and it's spot on. I think there is a lot of money to be made. In fact, there's a lot of money to be made in the entire industry, particularly by growers, but not solely. I think a lot of people are beginning to get into the industry. I will say that a lot of the people I've met in various phases of the industry, whether it's in testing or growing or running dispensaries, are people who began using medical marijuana for themselves and found it to be helpful and wanted to spread the gospel, so to speak, by opening various businesses. So a couple of growers I've met got into growing because they had experiences, good experiences themselves, and became believers. I don't know of any organized studies of surveys of who becomes a grower. I can tell you I've met a couple of people straight out of college who set up a growing facility. I've met somebody who was in the Army, was honorably discharged from the Army and was looking for a career path and set up a farm. I've also talked to people who run a string of dispensaries who, in a very corporate way, decided to set up growing facilities, farms, so they could develop their own supply chain in a very, very corporate kind of way, and a lot of other people in between. So it really, in my informal survey, if you will, it really seems to span the spectrum of all sorts of people getting into business.
But I can't imagine the administrative and regulatory hoops one would have to jump through in order to qualify as a grower.
Well, it varies from state to state, and yes, there are a fair amount of regulatory hoops, maybe not as many as there should be, frankly. I mean, if you think of fruits and vegetables and meat and dairy products, for instance, that we eat every day, and you think about all the testing that those have to go through to be declared safe, A lot of states don't have anywhere near the kind of testing, for instance, that's required to make sure your spinach is free of bacteria or your eggs are safe to eat. And I think that's changing. So there are some regulatory hoops, certainly, and some testing requirements, but I'd actually like to see those get more strict. One of the biggest challenges that many growers, dispensary owners have told me about is the challenges of working in an area and dealing with a substance or substances that are, you know, marijuana-derived products that are still federally illegal. And I heard a lot of stories about dispensary owners who couldn't get loans, who couldn't set up bank accounts, farmers who couldn't arrange for delivery of fertilizer from major suppliers because of the nature of what they were growing. That seems to be, at least right now, more of a barrier to many people than regulatory requirements.
And what about overseeing the safety of medical marijuana plants, for example, the use of pesticides and herbicides and so forth?
Yeah, again, that seems to vary a lot from state to state. In researching the book, I spent some time in a laboratory in Denver in Colorado called Can Labs, and they do a lot of testing for products that are sold, marijuana products that are sold in the state of Colorado, and told me some really interesting stories of contaminants that they found, pesticides, bacteria, other things you don't want to see in anything that you're eating or smoking. And also described going back to some of the growers and saying, look, you know, you've got some contaminants in your products. Here's how you get rid of them in a really constructive way. And that's kind of an example for me of the way I think this industry should be working. It doesn't work that way in every city and every state, but it really should.
Are there any GMOs when it comes to marijuana plants?
Not that I've heard, although I wouldn't be surprised if that comes online as it has for everything else. That hasn't been something that's popped up in the conversations that I've had, but it can't be too far down the road.
When you just about a minute here before we head into another break, but what is the sort of the most revelatory thing that you discovered while researching this book?
Well, there were lots of surprises. I think briefly, and maybe we can talk about this more after the break, but I was really surprised at the risk of addiction with marijuana. I didn't really think of that as a risk at all, and it turns out it is actually a real risk, and there's a biological basis to it. That's not an indictment of medical marijuana. There are a lot of things we use every day that are addictive, but that was one risk that was really eye-opening because I really didn't expect it.
All right. We will take another time out and come back. We've got a full board, not surprisingly, a full board of callers waiting with questions and comments for David Kasseret as we discuss medical marijuana right here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Why don't you stay a while? This is Pat Benatar, running with the shadows of the night, bringing us back in here on Coast to Coast. And from our friends at listverse.com, some fascinating facts about hemp. Hemp, of course, being the cannabis strain, which is cultivated for industrial use, non-drug use, industrial hemp. All school books were made from hemp or flax paper until the 1880s. In fact, it was legal to pay taxes with hemp in America from 1631 until the early 1800s. Can you imagine paying taxes with hemp? Refusing to grow hemp in America during the 17th and 18th centuries was against the law. You could be jailed in Virginia for refusing to grow hemp from 1763 to 1769. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and other founding fathers grew hemp. Washington, this according to Washington and Jefferson's diaries, Jefferson smuggled hemp seeds from China to France, then to America. Benjamin Franklin owned one of the first paper mills in America, and it processed hemp. And the War of 1812 was fought over hemp. Napoleon wanted to cut off Moscow's export to England. Now, this is interesting. This is fascinating. The first Bibles, maps, charts, and even Betsy Ross's flag, the first drafts of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, were made from hemp. Back with more of my conversation with Dr. David Kasseret and your calls as we continue to discuss medical marijuana right here on Coast to Coast AM. From the Wild Card Line, Gene in Milwaukee, you are on the line here on Coast to Coast with Dr. David Kasseret. Go ahead, Gene.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm Richard. And hi, doctor. Good topic. I want to be like your English teacher patient and inspire you to take up a new area of conversation in terms of medical marijuana. We all know that marijuana stimulates digestion and its efficacy for cancer patients with nausea. And I have anecdotal experiences having suffered gallbladder disease ever since I was a teenager that marijuana helps alleviate gallbladder attack. You know, if you go to the emergency room, there's no treatment for that. There's, because it's a visceral problem. You can't give someone morphine to stop the pain. And it's one of the worst kinds of pains there is, like having a kidney stone or something. But it actually stimulates the biliary functions. And I think that's part of the power of marijuana, is that this unresearched, uninvestigated capacity.
Gene, unfortunately, your cell phone is cutting out there, but let me get David in here to comment on the use of marijuana to stimulate appetite. This is a problem not only with patients undergoing chemotherapy and radiation, but also the elderly in general that tend to lose their appetite.
Yeah, so there are a couple of related effects there that we know something about, and we actually have some evidence for. One is that marijuana seems to be effective, at least there's some evidence that it's effective in relieving nausea that's associated with chemotherapy. And interestingly, the mechanism by which people become nauseated due to chemotherapy is similar to the way in which you become nauseated due to the gastrointestinal problems, like those that the caller mentioned. I don't know of any specific studies related to marijuana and gallbladder disease, for instance, but in general, the kinds of problems that cause nausea with GI distress are, oddly enough, similar, use the same mechanisms and the same neurotransmitters, serotonin in particular, that cause nausea associated with chemotherapy. So there's reason to believe that might be a fruitful area of research. The other area that you mentioned is loss of appetite that occurs to some degree in older adults, occurs often very profoundly in patients with cancer or AIDS or other chronic aggressive wasting diseases. There's, I think, pretty good evidence that cannabinoids, marijuana in particular, as well as specific cannabinoids like THC, improve appetite. Less evidence, at least on my read of the literature, less evidence that marijuana is able to increase weight gain. Often in those diseases, there's so much appetite loss combined with a revved up metabolism that it's really hard for people to maintain weight, and they develop this wasting syndrome. But certainly for my patients who want to at least maintain an appetite because it makes them feel normal. They want to engage in meals with friends and family, increasing their appetite. Even if they know they won't gain weight back, maintaining that appetite can be important to people.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies, and Richard is in Ohio this morning. Good morning, Richard. Welcome to Coast.
Good morning. I am a person with epilepsy, and marijuana has totally changed my life. For over 4 years, I was having grand mal seizures. I was a victim of a random act of violence. I never had epilepsy in my life. Numerous doctors told me that I could not work no more and I should go on disability. And if it was not for marijuana, I would not be able to maintain a normal life. I have horrible side effects from the medication. I do have weight loss. It's hard to eat. I do have insomnia, and I do have pain throughout all my muscles from so many severe seizures. I eventually ended up in a coma. My doctors, they were against marijuana and against their suggestions. I started using it after doing some research. I have not had a seizure in a year. It was the only thing that was able to stop me from having seizures. I would not be able to work if it wasn't for it. So I don't understand people like the last caller that tried to say that it makes people not motivated. There are millions of people who are successful and use marijuana, including myself. I work for a company that is on the stock market. I can't exactly say who, because I will probably get fired, and I'm in a state that it's illegal.
It is right now, but there's pending legislation, I understand, Richard, to legalize medical marijuana in Ohio.
Yes, there is. And the problem is I've never broke a law in my life other than using a medicine that helps me. And it puts you in a position where you have to decide on if you're going to lose your livelihood, if you're going to go to jail, or if you're going to use something that genuinely helps you. And as far as that person from the Army gentleman, without all due, disrespect, there are people who have never used marijuana that are unmotivated. The children, that's how kids are. I never used marijuana before I had epilepsy, and I used to be like that in school. You know, a lot of people aren't interested in learning, and they're unmotivated. I don't really know what to say against people who are so against it. I don't understand.
Well, Richard, let me get back to your particular use of marijuana. How, are you smoking it? Are you eating it? How are you taking it?
I've consumed it through smoking, and I also have used edibles. And, you know, as far as that guy goes, you know, I don't want to attack him.
Well, that's his personal experience. I'd rather talk about your case, Richard, but let me get David in here to comment on what you've said. David, any further comment on Richard?
Sure. I'm delighted that it's going well for you, honestly. I've talked to patients who have had great experiences as you have had. I've also talked to the patients who have not had such success. So I think that's great news, and I wish you all the best. I think that's one more reason why we need a better source of crowdsourced science about medical marijuana. That's what let my students and I started this Kickstarter campaign for marijuanaresults.org, so people could begin to share these stories in an organized way to begin to point each other in the right direction and to point researchers toward where we should be investigating. Because ultimately, I think we'll change some laws state by state, but if you want to try to turn employers around and get employers to understand that marijuana can be useful and how it can be useful, that's really going to take some data and some research, and that's where we need to get.
How much are you hoping to raise with your Kickstarter fund?
Our initial goal was a pretty modest $20,000, with some stretch goals up to $50,000 for a mobile app that people could use. So in the overall scheme of things, and we consider what Big Pharma spends on development and makes on drugs in a single minute, what we're asking for to crowdsource the science of medical marijuana is literally pennies.
All right, and give us the website for that, the Kickstart program.
If you go to Kickstarter, it's marijuanaresults, all one word, .org. If you search for marijuanaresults.org on Kickstarter, you should find the campaign.
All right. To Redding, California we go, and Kathy is with us on the Wildcard Line. Good morning, Kathy. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen, Richard and Dr. David. Just a couple of comments. I'll try to be as quick and forward as I can be. I have a brain malformation. My skull did not develop as my brain did, so my brain started growing down the back of my spine, which is Chiari malformation. It caused headaches worse than migraines. I also have, I had 3 bulging discs in my neck. I had surgery on that. I have a bulge disc on my lower back, and I now have 2 bulge discs in my neck. The doctor that I used to have before my surgery First, he had me on morphine. He had me on so much morphine, I couldn't move. He then switched me to 240 milligrams a day of OxyContin. I was in a comatose state because of that for about 2 years. And that was after my neck surgery and my surgery on the Chiari. Then, after that, he switched me to the fentanyl patch. That threw me for a mental loop. I had a very bad reaction to that. I had enough of that doctor. I went to a cannabis doctor and told him my story. He prescribed me a certain amount of milligrams per month, suggested that I use the edibles because I do have COPD. In the morning, I use tincture, and it's for the pain only. It's not for high. And I put two drops under my tongue. Within that half an hour, my pain is gone. Throughout the day, if I go out in public, I take, they make like little Jolly Rancher suckers. They also make lollipops and other edibles, but I use the lollipops and the Jolly Ranchers, like when I went to physical therapy. I knew I would be hurting, so I would take a couple Jolly Ranchers with me, and I would use them while I was doing physical therapy. And it helped tremendously.
That's great news, yeah. Kathy. David, did you want to comment on that further?
No, I think you did mention one form of medical marijuana that we haven't really talked about. We've talked about edibles, smoking, and vaporizing. Tinctures are, I know that's just one part of what the caller used, but it's a form of medical marijuana that people don't really know much about. And it's basically very high concentrations of THC or CBD or both that are dissolved in very, very small quantities of alcohol, not enough to get you drunk, certainly, usually just a couple of drops, as the caller said, under the tongue, which offers often fairly quick absorption, faster absorption than you get from edibles, without some of the hassles and challenges of smoking or vaporizing. It is one of the, not one of the newer ways of using marijuana. It's actually been around for more than 100 years. But it's gaining currency because it's so convenient and so reliable. You can use one or two drops in the same way day after day and know that you're getting the same dose. And I'm glad that she stumbled across that way of using medical marijuana, and I'm glad it's been successful for her. That's great news.
I had no idea that they were fashioning lollipops and Jolly Ranchers out of cannabis. Teresa is in Rome, Georgia. We've just got time for a quick comment. Teresa, good morning.
Well, good morning, Richard and David. I do appreciate your time, and I'll try to be very brief. I speak for Heaven's Earthly Ministry, Philadelphia. I know it's very sad that we are a nation under God, but we don't know what God says about this pleasant, renowned plant. It's a green herb bearing seed that he placed here. And if you read Malachi chapter 3 and Genesis number 1, and you look into Scripture, you will find this all over the place. I wish we had more time to talk about it. Isaiah 17:10 does teach you that they started setting the pleasant plant in strange slips and forgot to do the working will of God with it. But God intends for this plant to be used. And if you would just read Scripture, then you would find this out. Now, Larry O'Toole, just quickly, David, if you could get in touch with him, he's in Arizona at New Hope Hospital. He can even turn terminal cancer around for patients with hemp oil. And I guess that's about it since we don't have much time, but you can check in Genesis 1 and 29, Isaiah 17:10, Malachi, the last the chapter of the Holy Old Testament, you'll find before Jesus came that's where they started robbing God of his plant and wouldn't do what he wanted with it. And he'll pour out blessings from the windows of heaven if you will give it back. And our nation won't be headed for trouble like China and Greece are right now. Instead, we can teach other nations how to grow God's herb like London did when they sent farmers over here 1,000 years ago. They sent them over here to grow hemp. Man, mess that up. We can fix it.
All right, Teresa, I appreciate the call. David, I think you would agree we have to be careful about, making this sort of rationale that just because it's a plant that occurs naturally that we should, it shouldn't be illegal. Cocaine, heroin derived from, plants that grow and they're readily available. That doesn't mean they should be legal necessarily.
Right, I think that's true. In the book, I tell the story, in the book Stone, I tell the story of a meeting with the dispensary owner. I was asking him how he counsels patients about the risks of marijuana, and he said, marijuana doesn't have any risks, man. It's a flower, not like morphine. Forgetting that morphine is an opioid. Opioids come from poppies, and poppies are also flowers. So there are a lot of plants out there that are dangerous, natural, but dangerous. I think we need to be careful about saying that because it's natural, it's automatically safe. On the other hand, I think we also have to be careful about the flip side of that argument, which is that because marijuana makes you feel high, makes you feel euphoric, depending on how you use it, and whether it has a lot of THC or a little, that therefore it should be bad. Those are two flip sides to the same coin that can be dangerous and harmful to patients. And in the book Stone, The Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, that was one of the overarching themes I tried to get at. But there are all these opinions, often very strong opinions, based on arguments on either side that may seem logical on the surface but don't really make much sense once you dive into them. And that's what I spent my time doing in researching and writing the book, to try to get underneath some of these myths and misconceptions on both sides.
David, thank you so much. I enjoyed hanging out with you. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Love the show. Thanks.
Thank you. David Cassaret. For George Norrie, George Napolis Alliance, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Sean Latasur, Jeff Duray, Gina Silvati, and here in Toronto, Gord Harris, Scott Guest, and Tom Schenck, a.k.a. Philip Seymour Hoffman, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your voices, your beautiful voices.